for me. What would you say are the primary roles in your life right now? Any volunteers? Yes.
Child of God.
Okay, child of God is number one for all of us.
Wife.
Okay.
Mother.
Mm-hmm.
Administrative assistant. Student. Friend.
Okay, good. That's perfect. How many is that? Six? All right, six. That's good. How about somebody else? Yes.
Child of God. Husband. Student. Manager. Employee. Youth leader. Friend. And counselor.
Okay, good. Now, take some of those, like take youth leader for instance. Underneath youth leader, aren't there going to be a number of other roles that you play? Counselor's one, friend is one, but I assume when you say friend, you're meaning, you know, friend to people who are your peers from your past and in your presence as well. All right, somebody else? List. Steve, you got a list?
Yeah.
All right, go ahead. Talk loud.
Your intern, if that's such a thing, maintenance worker, then son, uncle, and brother, because of my weird family situation.
Okay, so yeah, so each of those is a different role. Now, The professionals tell us that you shouldn't have more than how many roles?
Five.
Seven is the number. David's probably read something I asked him to read. But seven is kind of the number. Now, I don't think they can prove that. Like, oh, if you have eight, you're doing too much. Or five, you know, you really are kind of a slacker. Because you can define roles in a lot of different ways. In fact, when I listed my roles, I realized, oh, I've got way too many, and so I need to cut back. So instead of really saying, oh, I need to eliminate things, I basically just got more creative with my titles. So instead of saying child of God, husband and father blended into family, which is fine, and then I went on down another list. I began to realize, though, once I get over seven, because I really do try to keep it about seven, that there are some things that I'm not putting a priority on. And the reason I'm not is because I don't have time. This is a dangerous place. When I was in college, there was an article written about me in a Young Life journal. A friend of mine that I worked with in Young Life was writing an article for their national magazine and decided to do one on me. I'm embarrassed that that article was ever written. And the reason I'm embarrassed was because of the way I was living my life. It wasn't in great sin, but it was completely unbalanced. The title of the article was, He Wears Three Hats. And what it was doing was lifting up someone who's addicted to activity. The first hat I wore was that I was a student, full-time college student at the University of Central Oklahoma. I'd say go, but I'm not sure what our mascot was. Is it Broncos?
Broncos.
Okay, he's from that town, but he didn't go there. Second role was I was a paid intern for a church. Third role was I worked for a company called St. John's Ladies Apparel, which I probably don't have enough time on tape to explain what that means. Basically, it was a chain of women's stores, and I, along with the owner, were the only two men in the whole organization, but I was the grunt. I was the one who went and did all the errands and, you know, put up the light bulbs and cleaned the restrooms and did all that kind of fun stuff. And so I had these three major things in my life, which occupied a lot of time. I worked 20 hours a week for the St. John's place, worked about, you know, 15 to 20 for the church, and then I was a full-time student. And so they're like, ooh, this guy, this is great. Look at him go. Instead, somebody should have been writing articles about addicted to activity. That should have been the title. And they should have talked about the way it was really destroying many key parts of my life. My relationship with God, my relationship with my family. I wasn't married or anything like that yet. But I had a terrible relationship with my mom and dad and brothers and sisters because I was never there. I couldn't be there. I was too busy doing ministry. I have found that that is a beautiful metaphor, really, for what the rest of my life has been like. The temptation of so many good things coming at me, just as they do to you, that it'll be real easy to go, yeah, I'm excited about all the different activities. I'm excited about all these roles in my life. When you realize that every one of them are going to be at some level in conflict with the primary role of your life. Even your family, compared to the greatness of a relationship with God, isn't as high. But they're all going to occupy and try to compete for that number one position. Does that make sense? And so as that takes place, we have to back up and really consider what are the most significant roles. And then as I said earlier, I realize as I look at my roles that there's some that are very precious to me that I don't put any time into. because I'm too busy. And one of them is friend. I realized not long ago, that's a significant role. But I don't talk to friends in the past very much. I don't talk to, you know, friends that I've nurtured relationships with since I was little. Why? Well, there's just not enough time. And I understand the stage of life when you've got little kids and all those things. But it wasn't that. It was that I was letting other things become a higher priority so that I wouldn't make those phone calls. And it's not like they were expecting me to, but it's something I wanted. Does that make sense? And so the time management that I want to show you just briefly is centered on the roles of our life and taking time each week, I think in the presence of God, as we're praying to Him, Lord, help me balance. Help me have boundaries with what all I'm supposed to do. And it starts with your roles. Now, I'm going to use mine just as an example because I know them the best. First of all, I'm a child of God. I know then on a given week that there are certain things that I want to do in my relationship with God. I want to spend time with Him. In the morning, it's my best time. I really want to be with Him in the morning. Some of you would be at night, afternoon, at lunch. It doesn't matter. But I know that that's a priority. Second priority is I am a family man. I've got three little ones, 16 months, a little over three, a little over five. They take time. And I've got a dear wife that I love to spend time with. Then I get into other specific roles. Now, these are some of the roles that I have. I use the word shepherd to indicate what I do as a pastor. This means I'm going to go spend time with people, shepherding them in their relationship with Christ. Another word that I use is teacher. This includes anything I do, whether it's teaching, you know, a class like this occasionally, or Sunday school, or preaching, whatever it is. Another role I have is, I use the word developer. That is developing new ideas, new programs, new events for our ministry. Another role is administrator. Now, you already know, you know, strengths and weaknesses there. But I recognize that if I'm in the position as a director of something, that's going to have with it inherently some administrative role. I've got to do that. Another role that I use is now what I call friend. Now, there are lots of other ones that I love to put up there, just as there will be for you too. Like, I would love to be a guitar player. I'm not. I stink. I would love to get better. But right now in my life, there's not time for that. I could scratch out friend and probably do that. I could scratch out administrator and probably do that. But there's just not time. I have to accept that. I would love to make a model railroad. I mean, I do that with my dad. I want to do it with my kids someday. But I'd love to just build. I mean, that'd be a hobby that I would love to just take a huge table. Because I used to want to be an architect and just architect a little world. It'd be so cool and fun. There's just no time for that right now in my life. I would love to be, you know, a lot of different things. But you realize that there's limitations on the time God has given us. We can't do everything we want, so we've got to choose based on boundaries. So the way I do time management isn't on tasks. I don't start my week with a massive list of tasks. I start my week by looking at the priorities of who I want to be and who God's called me to be. So under each of these, instead of identifying just, oh, I got these neat roles, I specifically think about each of them and how I want to utilize them. Now, roles also rotate. For instance, I may scratch out the role of developer one week in order to focus on role of leader. And that means I'm going to spend more time that week focusing on developing leaders within my own leadership team. Does that make sense? Or there might be writer. There might be a week where I really want to focus on writing something, a letter or an article, and so I focus on that. But I'm not called to be a writer. That's not a role I have every day of my life. Does that make sense? And so these are rotating, some of them. Now, these don't rotate. You know, they don't. They're primary. But as I look at them on a given week, I'll take time and I'll step back and say, okay, what are two or three things within each of these roles that I could accomplish this week? So, child of God, I want to go into the, you know, state park. I go to a place called Castlewood, and I want to spend significant time on Monday afternoon or Monday morning being alone with the Lord. I know I need it. I'm going to carve that out. And so in my schedule, I'm going to say Monday, no appointments. Maybe the whole day, maybe part of a day. It doesn't matter. With my family, I know that I this week want to take my kids to the park, or I want to read them a new book. My wife and I are going to go out on Thursday night. You know what? I want this to be a special date this week. I want it to be more creative. So I'm going to do this. And so I step back and I think about my week and what that's going to look like. I then moved to the role of shepherd. And so instead of just going, who can I contact with this week? I have a strategy. I look at the list of students in our group. I pray over them and I think, who should I spend time with? What parent, what student, and what leader? And I typically go through that kind of a framework because I really want to have good relationships with parents, with students, and with our leaders. And so I'll make a list. And typically it looks like, who am I going to write a note to? Which group of people will I, that's in the way now, make a phone call to? And who will I try to have a one-on-one with? And I'll go through that. Teacher, when am I going to prepare? Because one of the values of my life is I want to be prepared. I don't want to just show up, even though it's just high school students, and just pull out a passage and begin to just make stuff up as I go. I think that's wrong, and I think it's sinful. And so I want to be prepared as a teacher, as a developer or leader this week. What's one or two things I want to do as a developer? You know, what's something I want to work on missions for our church? Okay, I'm going to spend 1 hour at some point in the week and focus on missions. Administrator, what are the big projects coming up that I need to pay attention to? And then a friend. If I could call one friend a week, it wouldn't take that long. It'd be a pretty incredible thing. And so I start there based on values, the things I value in my life, and the roles I have in my life. And that begins to push towards the way I manage my week. Does that make sense? So it doesn't start with just a massive task list. Instead, it starts with the roles in my life. Then it moves towards task. In other words, you know what the major tasks are. You probably have a record of them somewhere. How do they flood in to each given role? And then I manage it that way. How do I do it? By evaluation. Each week, what I'll do, or each day, I step back at the end of the day, as I reflect on the day, and I look at each thing. All right? And I grade myself, just as I would if I was in an academic setting. A, B, C, D, and F. If on a given day I was supposed to write a note as a shepherd, I'll make a little note by that, which means fail. I'm failing in that right now. I said I was going to do that today. I didn't. And then I'll put an arrow, which means tomorrow, and I'll go ahead and record that on the next day. With a circle I'll put next to it, meaning that I failed the day before. I don't want another F to go there. I need to get that done. Does that make sense? Because it's a value. Do I have to do it? Will the person be mad if I don't? Not in that case. They don't even know a little note's coming. But I know it's something I need to do to fulfill the value that I have in that role. And so I'll go through each one. Then at the end of a given week, I'll look at the whole thing. I've never had a week where I accomplished it perfectly. Never. But I feel far more effective at what I've accomplished as opposed to if I just had this massive task list that I was scratching things off with. Because there's a lot of things on a task list that might not really be that important compared to these things of your life. And that's where you get advanced in time management. It's trying to distinguish between what is urgent and important versus what is not urgent but is very important. And then there's obviously the other paradigm, which is focusing on not urgent and not important things. That'd be things like getting on the internet and just looking up all kinds of stuff or watching TV and just kind of wasting time. So we've got to really think about how do we use our time most effectively. And this is one of the ways that I've done that. Now, this is not my invention. It's in a lot of different time management books. But it would benefit you greatly to take time to learn and study how do you work. Now, some of you might be going, yeah, I've seen that before. I've read it. I don't know how to do it. I've tried it. It didn't work for me. I'm not that kind of person. Well, if you're not, then you need to ask why and be honest. Is it because you're too lazy to do it? Is it because it takes too much time? Or is it because you just aren't disciplined enough to stay focused on task? I am a perfect case study of how something like this, for somebody who naturally isn't drawn to that, can make it happen. In fact, once I started doing it, and I could be in an infomercial on these things, once I started doing it and seeing the results, I realized this is powerful. And it really works. You know, and different people use different things. For instance, my planner is huge. I've got one of those that holds 8.5 by 11 sheets of paper in it. I started with a little bitty dinky one. Then I went to one of these sizes, and I gradually went up. And now I keep a huge one, not because I like to walk around going, look at me, I'm administrative giant, because it's not true. But I realized I have a lot of papers and reports that I get on different things. And so I like it where I don't have to fold papers up to put it in it. I just have a nice 3-ring binder. It pops in there, and I keep my planner right there, and I keep it on. I don't carry it everywhere. It's not with me right now, but it's on my desk, and it has everything I need to keep track of what's taking place. Does that make sense? Some people love the PDAs, you know, the personal data system. How many of you have one? I'm just kind of curious. You've got one? Is that it? Just one? Lots of people had them. I had one. And the best thing that ever happened was when I left it on an airplane and it got stolen. I mean, I walked off the plane. It was a Delta flight in Denver, Colorado. I walked off the plane, got to the end of the gate, turned a corner, walked towards the luggage carousel, and realized, I mean, in 3 minutes, oh, I left my planner. Walked back. Oh, we don't have it. I know exactly. I said, oh, it's in the seat right in front of me. I left it right there. I remember putting it in there. And they're like, I'm sorry, it's not there. Well, somebody swiped it. It was a nice one, and you know how it goes. And so it was stolen. Well, that was the best thing that ever happened because I did not find it helpful. Most people love them. They think they're great. But I need to be able to see the big picture. So this says something about my personality. And so as I have to look at the big picture, I realize I don't need that thing. I can't see enough right there. And so I don't use it. You like yours? Okay, so this isn't a class that's promoting the Palm Pilot. However, lots of people love them, so I'm not saying don't use them. I have many friends who love it. You know, they're zapping each other with all their phone numbers and stuff. They're really cool. But I didn't find it to be very helpful. So I went back to the old school. The point is, find what works for you. Keep it. Some of you want to have a nice binder. Great. Some of you, you know, you want to keep it in just a little dollar binder. That's fine, too. But use them. Use what works because it's incredible when you can keep track of stuff and begin to realize I'm making progress in the areas that I'm doing. Any questions about time management stuff that or comments? Is anybody like, hey, I'm a master at it, and Mark, I think you're an idiot. This is what you should do. Any at all? All right. Good. I'm glad. I hope you do well in that. I know it's going to be challenging. If you fail, this is a great line. If you fail, you're using it, you fail. One day you just didn't get anything done. Your day just got away from you. Will you have days like that? Absolutely. God will make sure you do so you're dependent on Him. Start again immediately. In anything you do, if you fail, start again immediately. Just, okay, yep, I choked on that. I know I'm committed to it. I need to start again and start again immediately. Well, we're going to make kind of an abrupt transition. There's a video that I want to show in the remainder of this section, and then on video you'll... for the Access students, you'll see more of the video later. But I really want you to see a video that came out. We're getting ready to talk about youth ministry and an electronic age as we finish up the semester. And then we're going to talk about some models, just introductory, of family-based youth ministry. But there's a video before we get there that I wanted to show you guys this semester at some point. And based on the events of September 11th, when we had to cancel class, this had to be pushed back. The video we're going to see was put out by PBS and their news magazine called Frontline, which if you have a chance to watch it periodically, at least check the newspaper to see what they're showing, because they often will do documentaries on youth, and they do them very well. Some people would say they're a bit sensationalist at times, but I really do believe that they try to do it with integrity, and there's an interesting perspective that they bring. The video that we're going to watch is called The Lost Children of Rockdale County, which is a video. How many have seen it? I'm just kind of curious. Rockdale, okay, it's a great video. Rockdale County is a community outside of Atlanta, and they'll kind of give you this context as the video starts. But it's a powerful, very, very powerful video about a group of students, mostly at that time middle-aged or mid-high-age students who go into high school, who get into this conflict of a sexual identity crisis and sexual activity that's going to horrify you. I want you to know ahead of time, if you're easily offended by gross just activity that's just heinous, you need to know that. And you have permission to step up and walk out of the class. It's not promoting it at all, of course. Instead, it's saying this is a reality of what has happened in a community, and you need to be aware. There are powerful implications for us as a church. And the reason is because the church is clearly described in this footage in how they respond to a crisis like this. And I want you, as you watch it, to be paying attention to what's going on. What should the church's response be? How did the church respond? Was it effective? Or was it ineffective? And the reason is because as it gets towards the end of the day, we probably won't even get there in this section, you began to really see some things the churches in the area did really well, and some things that churches didn't do that well. And it's certainly in relationship to what we've been talking about in terms of relationships with students. Be thinking particularly of Larry Crabb's book, Connecting, which you guys read, and how that could play a role in these types of students' lives. So, enjoy.
Twenty-five miles east of Atlanta, Georgia's Interstate 20 reaches Rockdale County and its only town, Conyers. Just off the exit is a mile-long strip of fast food restaurants and chain stores, which serves as Conyers' downtown. Most people here live in newly built subdivisions with names like Ivy Bluff, Ansbrook, and Martha's Vineyard, carved out of what not long ago was pastoral farmland. Rockdale County is the outer edge of what has been called the fastest growing settlement in human history, the rings of suburbs surrounding Greater Atlanta. Most children here go to one of three high schools, Heritage, Salem, or Rockdale. Fattened with tax dollars, they are among the best in the state. It was a surprise then when something happened among a number of the teenagers here that revealed a life unknown to their parents. It was the spring of 1996. Most people in Conyers were focused on the upcoming Atlanta Summer Olympics.
Number 149 in the Younger Children's Hunters, Hudson.
The town had been chosen to host the equestrian events and had built a new horse park for the occasion. Few people, therefore, noticed a small article appearing in a local paper. It reported an outbreak of syphilis among some 20 people, most of them teenagers. And it hinted at the possibility that many more had been infected.
I actually called my colleagues, and at the time I said, hey, you're not going to believe this. We have an outbreak of syphilis in a middle-class, white, largely white community, a suburb of Atlanta. Worse, it's right near one of the venues of the Olympics.
Kathleen Toomey is the director of Georgia's Division of Public Health.
What was unusual about this particular outbreak is that it focused around a group of young girls. They were described to me as almost cherubic in some of their characteristics. And again, very young, some of them 13 years of age.
This was so totally out of line with everything that we had ever seen. Teenagers, especially young white females, do not get syphilis. But in our case, they did.
Who has my chart?
Cynthia Noel, a nurse at the county's public health department, was one of the first to discover the outbreak when an adolescent boy appeared complaining of symptoms of syphilis. Noel questioned the boy about his sexual contacts.
One of the girls that he had been with was actually our key to the entire epidemic. She had had numerous sexual partners, and when we brought her in, had a positive blood. And we started really with her finding the other partners, and as it broadened into bigger and bigger circles.
Noelle and her colleagues constructed a chart tracing the sexual histories of each infected teenager. As the investigation progressed, the number of contacts named by the kids multiplied and multiplied again.
What we were told by a lot of the kids was that there was a lot of sexual activity with multiple partners, a lot of risky sexual activity. These girls were not just having regular intercourse. They were having every kind of possible sexual act that you could do.
State health officials, fearing a widening epidemic, called in Claire Sterk, a Dutch-born professor at Emory University's School of Public Health. It was to Sterk that some of the children began to reveal the details of their sexual activity.
It was not uncommon when all the young people would get together to engage in group sex. There was group sex going on in terms of one guy having sex with one of the girls and then the next guy having sex with the same girl. There was group sex going on in terms of one girl having sex with multiple male partners at the same time, multiple females having sex with each other at the same time. I would say the only type of group sex that I did not hear about in his overall context was group sex between just guys.
In the end, 17 young people tested positive for syphilis. More than 200 others were exposed and treated. Approximately 50 of them reported being involved in extreme sexual behavior.
You don't expect to see a 14-year-old with 20, 30, 40, 50, or 100 sex partners. You expect that of someone who is more into the line of being a prostitute or something. And these girls were not homeless. They were not abused in any way. These were just normal, everyday, regular kids.
Cindy owns an antique store in Conyers. At the height of the epidemic, her daughter Nicole was among the 200 young people called into the health department to be tested. Cindy went with her.
How did you feel when you heard that she had to go into the health department?
You should never have to do that. But I wanted to be there with her. I felt like it would be a traumatic experience. It wasn't. We walked in there, and it was like hitting a brick wall. Here are these kids that are high-fiving each other, laughing. I do not believe a single one of them realized what they're dealing with.
We thought it was funny. Thought it was, ooh, you got syphilis, ooh, you know. I mean, we knew. It's like the cooties game the little kids play, you know.
Nicole is Cindy's daughter. She was 15 at the time of the outbreak.
They gave everybody the shot, if you had it or not, before you got tested. So you never knew who had it or not. Now if I look back at pamphlets and syphilis, oh my God. You know, but then it went in to something else. We got over.
It all began, investigators would determine, with a loosely knit group of friends. In many ways, they were indistinguishable from other teenagers in Conyers. Most drove nice cars, lived in new homes, and on weekend nights gathered on the strip, looking for something to do.
It was a great cross-section. Just every imaginable profile of a child was in this group of students. It was not aimed at a child who had a car, didn't have a car. Not aimed at a child who was a good student versus a bad student. A child who was a football player versus a band participant. It was a cross-section of children.
Not all of them knew each other well. Not all would be exposed to syphilis. And not all would take part in group sex. But they were all caught up in the strange events of the spring and summer of 1996.
There's always a group of us. Well, we never did anything except what we wanted to do, which was hang out. We wanted them to think, ooh, look at them, them kids are whatever. We liked the stairs. We started dressing, big baggy clothes, big, like, wild T-shirts and stuff. And the girls would wear dark, dark lipstick and eyeliner just to get stares or attention or something, not to be normal, maybe.
For a while, some of them made themselves conspicuous in town, shoplifting, blaring music, and defying the midnight curfew for teenagers under 16.
We would ride around in Conyers 3 o'clock in the morning in somebody's parents' car and never think about getting caught. We never thought about consequences back then.
I think one of the reasons that they liked me was because I had a car, and a lot of them didn't have a car. And so they called me up a lot and saying, come pick me up. And that was a big mistake because I ended up driving everybody around everywhere.
Amy grew up in Rockdale County. By the time she reached high school, she had fallen out with her old friends. Gradually, she began to make new ones.
I guess they just gave me the friendship that I just was looking for.
We went to somewhere, like, out to eat or something, just to get something to eat, I would always try to get out to see other people and just say, ha, look who I'm with.
One kid many of them wanted to be seen with was DJ, a 14-year-old known for his charm and a streak of recklessness.
I didn't really want to be notorious. I wanted to be popular. I wanted to be famous. I wanted people to like me. I didn't want people to hate me. I always tried to be the likable one, and I could be.
DJ had money and little supervision at home. His parents were divorced, and he had moved in with a family friend whom he called his godfather.
My father is a good businessman. My godfather, he would buy me really anything. And just give me all the money I wanted, anytime I needed it, whatever I wanted, he'd buy it for me.
Kevin was a good friend of DJ's at the time.
He'd have a party with like 200 people. Everybody would get drunk, spend the night, swim in the pool. His dad didn't care what he did.
There were lots of parties back then, anywhere that adults weren't around. The kids would meet in empty homes all over Conyers, sometimes in rented motel rooms. Kevin did not take part in their activities, but he knew about them.
There was a lot of sex going on there. Like, one girl would come in the group and she'd be passed around, or one guy would go in the girls' group and get passed around.
Passed around?
Yeah, one guy would do it with her one night, next night somebody else has her, next night somebody else has her.
Was this a game?
Pretty much.
There was a lot of sex then, about 16 years old. A lot of sex. We would fight. There was about four of the guys that drove BMWs and had everything, and those were all the girls wanted to be with those guys, so we'd all fight over them or do whatever. So I think that's, and then you'd have sex with them, so it'd be like, yeah, I had sex with your man last night, da 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 da. And I think that's how the syphilis came about, was everybody just having sex with everybody.
Actually, I mean, it was a social thing, but it was more of an underground railroad thing. It was just everybody was secretively having sex with everybody, and everybody knew it. Teenagers knew it, but parents never knew.
A lot of the adolescent had parents who worked, were at home alone, had parents who put in 40, 60, 80-hour work weeks, and were doing that to ensure that all the resources that they wanted to give to their children were available.
The activities they were involved in, whether it would be sexual or otherwise, the majority of their behavior was taking place between right after school and right before parents came home from work, like between 3 and 7, and some of it late at night then, after midnight, after parents would go to sleep.
Most of my friends' parents were not the kind of parents that really cared. They cared what went on, but if it interfered with their lives, then it really wasn't. They didn't want to bother with it.
Peggy Cooper, now retired, was a middle school guidance counselor. She reported to the health department that she was hearing stories of late-night sexual games involving kids as young as 12 years old.
My students were talking to me about the parties that they were having on weekends. And there was one place in particular that they had lots of privacy. The parents were often gone. And they said that they were watching the Playboy Channel and in the girls' bedroom. And there would be like 10 or 12 of them up there. And so I said, well, is everybody watching it? Oh, yeah, they're all watching it. And so one of the little guys goes, and we're getting pretty good at it, too. And I said, good at what? So he said, well, you have to do, the game is you have to imitate what the Playboy people are doing. And one of them said, and sometimes it's all mixed up, too. You know, it's just like, I mean, there may be three or four of us at one time. And it doesn't matter if you're two guys or two girls or a girl and a guy. It doesn't matter. You just have to do what they're doing.
And there's this one time when we were all at a party. There's about 30, 40 people there. And this one girl, they had been drinking. They were pretty drunk. And she, like, was going to have, she told everybody she was going to have sex with almost every guy that was there. And her and her friend went back in the bedroom. Her friend had sex with her boyfriend and came out. And then the girl stayed in there, and it was like all the guys lined up. And it was like they were from the door to the front door. I mean, it was a line of people. And we brought out the bag of condoms we got from the health department and passed them out. And like two guys would go in there, you know, and they were having sex with her. And they were like having oral sex and, you know, sex. And all the guys that, most of the guys that were there went in the room and had sex with her. And she came out, she was, just thought it was the coolest thing, just that she had just had sex with all them, or maybe they thought she was cool or whatever. But she was like bleeding and her hair had cum all in it and it was all over her clothes.
Did any of the girls describe the sex as pleasurable?
Initially, they described the sex as pleasurable. Pleasurable in terms of it being physically pleasurable, but also psychologically. Like, this was a initiation into the next step of their life. It was part of their development that was taking place. Over time, however, very few of the girls talked about the sex in terms of it being pleasurable at all. It became something that was painful, that in some cases they couldn't even remember they did anymore. So it became very negative.
Do you ever think they might have done it because they wanted to be accepted by the boys?
I don't think it was a real pressure issue. I mean, it might have been for them. Subliminally, it might have been. Subconsciously, it might have been. But it really, I mean, there really wasn't any pressure to it. It was more of, they just gave in, really.
How did the guys in general treat the girls?
They were mean to them a lot. They treated them like they were just, I don't know, not trash, but not very, like, respectable. And the girls seemed not to care. I don't know why. I guess they just, I think most of it was the alcohol that they were buying. Because the guys always bought alcohol. They just, they knew that we would like it. And so, they didn't treat us like we were anything real important.
You didn't ever get angry at them?
I did. A few times, but I couldn't really do anything about it because they wouldn't care. They just tell me to go home or something.
Why didn't you?
I don't know. I would be alone then.
Okay, Lonnie. Tame is at bat now, so let's watch her. Watch her. Watch her. She's going to hit this thing. She's going to hit it.
Amy lives with her parents in a spacious home in Princeton Way, one of Rockdale's wealthier subdivisions. Her father supervises security at a state university. Her mother, a school teacher, did not want to be interviewed.
We was very close family when they was younger. Still are. I think we spent a lot of time together. Gosh, vacations. We went on vacations till she was 16. We was very involved in softball. She and I coached her from the time she was 7, 8 years old until she was 18. We spent a lot of time together that way on the softball field. During those years, it was great. I couldn't ask for a better kid.
You were close.
Yes. Yes, we was. Probably not as close as we should be, but we was close.
Amy, smile. Can you wave?
I was good. I was really good.
Stand there, wave, or do something. Jump up and down.
Anything I did wrong, I would get scared, and I would have to tell my mom, oh, no. And I was like, oh, no, I'm bad. But I don't know why everything just changed. It just changed.
Amy's life began to change in middle school when she was about 13.
In seventh grade, I had this one best friend, and she was like my best friend ever since I was little. And then she got new friends, and she didn't like me anymore. So she kind of told me she didn't want me to sit next to her at lunch and all this stuff. And I felt kind of rejected. So then I didn't have very many friends throughout middle school after that.
Amy spent ninth grade on the cheerleading squad. In the 10th grade, she was cut from the team.
After that, it just sort of, I felt depressed a lot. I was just real unhappy. And I was okay outside of school, but I didn't have any kind of friends at school. And I guess I kind of picked the wrong friends outside of school, too.
When you came home from being out with all these kids and you saw your parents, what did you think?
I felt ashamed because I was like, oh, you know, I've been around some bad people and I'm coming home. And I would just, a lot of times I would try just to go down to my room and not have to talk to them. A lot of times I would be high when I came home. So I really try not to talk to them or look at them or anything.
I knew it was possible that it was happening, you know, that she was sexually active. But we didn't sit down and talk about the diseases and the dangers of that out there either. And I know it's there. I guess we could have talked more about what she was doing then, and we didn't. You know, we didn't talk that much about what was happening when she was not with us. I'm not a George Bush fan, but when he talked about the family unit and the breakdown of the family unit, that's the way it is. And as much as I do as much to destroy it as anybody else. We got TVs in every room of the house. I watch my programs. My wife watches her programs in another room in the house. You know, the kids would watch it or play on the Ataris, the video games. You mentioned a while ago about the time we spent together. Yeah, we would spend time together, but Much of the time that we had in the house together was not together.
Amy's life had begun to revolve around her new group of friends.
They would buy me alcohol. And so I was happy for a little while.
You like to drink?
I used to, yeah.
Why?
Because I always just got really happy, and I was always a different person when I was drunk.
What were you like?
I was real outgoing, and I would just talk to everybody and love everybody. Oh, I love you. When I was drunk, which is just totally different from when I'm sober.
When you're that young, to be cool, you know, you do some things that you don't want to do, but sometimes you have to. It's not like you have to, but
it's there.
Yeah.
You know, children, when they come into this world, want attention. And they'll get good attention as long as they can get it. If they can't get good attention, they'll get bad attention. Because the worst thing in the world to them is to have no attention. No attention is to lead a solitary life, finally.
I feel like I've never had anybody. Never had the family that would be there for you, the friends that would be there for you. I always felt like I was out in the cold.
DJ's parents were still together when they moved the family to Conyers.
When they started, they were both, my father was a policeman, and was, you know, the ideal couple. My mother was Miss Arkansas, and they were both very happy. And as things turned, my father, everything started going for the worst.
DJ's father left when he was 9. His mother, he says, fell apart.
My father was the only thing she ever had, and her kids. And then after he left, she didn't know how to deal with herself. I didn't even feel she was around. I couldn't deal with people my age. I didn't feel they could understand. And so I attached to people that were older than me.
DJ came to rely on his new friends and says he was anxious to impress them.
To us, it was just, you know, we were like brothers. We would stick up for each other. We wouldn't let anything come between us. And it was the closest thing I've ever had to a friendship. Me, I was always, since I was so young, I always had to prove myself. So I did, most of the time, I probably did the most drastic things. Not to actually do anything, but a lot of it came down to violence.
One day, when he was 14, DJ and his friend Joe made a plan.
We didn't plan, we wanted to kill everybody. Everybody in the world. We wanted to try to set the record of the most murders you could ever imagine. So I got really drunk. I got really, really drunk. We drank like a gallon of vodka. Got really smashed. We were hanging around all our friends, and there was this one guy that I really couldn't stand. Just couldn't stand him at all. He was just the biggest. And he said something to me that pissed me off. I said something horrible. And I just grabbed him by the back of his head, and I just stabbed him in the spine, and he threw him on the ground. And he was just sitting there, and he was bleeding, and he gets up, and I went to grab his neck, I wanted to cut his throat, just to make sure it was over with, to kill him.
How did it feel to stab him?
At the time, I felt great.
The boy survived, and DJ and his friend were never prosecuted.
What kind of person was DJ?
The badass. He was younger than everybody, but nobody would do anything to him. So everybody was afraid of his friends.
When DJ was around me, he acted totally different from when he was around his other friends. He felt like he could do anything to anybody and talk to him any kind of way. And they were scared to say anything to him because they were afraid that if he say something to DJ that I'm gonna send somebody to beat him up or whatever.
DJ's friend McGill has been a focus of the Rockdale police for years, in and out of jail for petty crimes. The more time he spent behind bars, the greater his appeal to both boys and girls around Conyers.
Tell me about McGill.
McGill. He was like the worst guy I ever met. He was like sort of the leader of this little gang thing. And everybody just looked up to him for some reason. I think that everybody was just scared of him.
McGill was... he was like my big brother. He was like my older brother. At the time, he was the most... I don't know. He was... everyone was terrified of him. So for him to be my big brother, for everybody to be then terrified of me...
He was a younger kid. He was about 13, and I was 17, 18. And usually, you know, older kids wouldn't hang around nobody that young. But DJ started giving everybody money just to be a friend. And back then, I didn't have no job or nothing, and he was giving us money, and the money was good. He was my best friend.
McGill and some of his friends, who came from a poorer section of the county, blended into the group.
We tried to terrify Conyers. We wanted to show everybody in Conyers that you couldn't hurt us. There's nothing you could do. It doesn't matter what you do. If you wanted to try, we would better, you know, we would completely overcome you. We would try to defeat you in any way.
Mm-hmm.
We all felt invincible. Nobody could do anything to us. We could do whatever we wanted to do, and we pretty much did everything we wanted to do.
This one party I went to was like, it was like a whole bunch of girls, a whole bunch of guys, and then they just sitting around and drinking, having a good time to party and smoking weed. Then around 12, 1 o'clock, when everybody got ready to go to sleep, everybody just get in the room. Girls start having sex with other girls, and guys start having sex with other girls, and it just, everybody just get in one room and just have sex.
All together?
Yeah. Girls having sex with girls, except guys. Guys don't have sex with each other, though. And cool.
Most of the girls were white, but the boys were racially mixed. This was yet another boundary the kids chose to cross.
There was a taboo that has not disappeared regarding sexual activity between African American men and white women. Here we're talking about white adolescents. So in many ways, what was happening here was that the girls not only were challenging community norms by being sexually active, but were challenging those even further by engaging, at least part of the time, in sexual activity with African American males.
You liked breaking rules?
Yeah. It was like, wasn't really I liked breaking rules, it was just, I didn't care. Your rules meant nothing to me. If they didn't benefit me, they got nothing to do with it. That's really how I felt then.
Okay, we just finished watching the first part of the Lost Children of Rockdale County, and we're just going to kind of discuss for a few minutes some of the things that just kind of struck you about the events that took place there. So, Steve, the picture, they do a good job, you know, of it's a suburb, and they call it middle class, and it's definitely more than that, you know, at least I would say so, maybe not in that area, but here they are in these big homes, and you just think, oh, it's all safe, it's perfect, but it's certainly an indication of a lot more than just the sexual activity. It says a lot about our society and the way in which we mask a lot of real deep issues by the material blessings that we have in Adam. All right. Good comment. Other things? Statements that somebody made. Yeah. Do you remember in this course we've talked about, you know, the number one influence on a student's life? Do you remember what it was?
Peers.
Number one was peers. It was friends. And let's talk about Amy for a minute, because she's the one in this first section that just grips my heart. Partly because I've got two little girls, and when they go to the softball scene, and you see her playing softball, and Dad's got his lips against her cheek, and there's just a lot of love. And you obviously, I mean, her parents still love her, but boy, you wonder what happened. You know, what are your thoughts? You know, as you saw Amy. Yeah, because that's a situation that happens a lot in high school ministry. As we're ministering to students, you'll see those kind of fallouts in relationships where kids were, you know, really close, and then for whatever. In fact, if you even think about your own life, for many of us, there's probably people that we were really good friends with in elementary school, and then something happened. You know, we change, they change, and all of a sudden, the relationships aren't the same. And here, it's devastating. You know, seventh grade, basically she's rejected, so she spends the rest of middle school trying to identify who she is. She decides cheerleading. That will be the thing, so she makes it as a cheerleader. As she goes on as a cheerleader, then she gets cut again, this massive rejection. And so it's a heart that's broken. How do you help her as parents? You know, what do you do? How do you invest in her life? And you can imagine, I think the comment she made was great. Well, we just want her to be happy. So what does it take? And I would imagine often it's buy her gifts, get her whatever she wants, help her, and that they think they're doing the right thing. That's a lot of the kinds of communities you'll be serving, parents and kids like that. It just breaks your heart. And it should break our hearts, because it really happened. Let's talk about the young man, the charming one. Very, very charming guy, isn't he? You know, situation, family's broken, he's living with somebody. Describe what you saw there with EJ. Just a lot of anger built up. Mm-hmm. It's a storm inside.
Yeah.
And there should be. I mean, his parents are, you know, they split up. There's all kinds of issues there. He's not living with them. He's living with a sugar daddy, somebody who's paying for everything. How do you feel about that? You know, the party's 200 people. They don't care. It is sometimes hard to believe that. It's just, that doesn't happen. But it really does happen. You know, shakes you out. Yeah. Whatever it takes. Think about DJ for a minute. Think about his normal everyday. What must it have been like for him to get up in the morning, go through school, make it through the day, and then begin to go, I mean, his foundation is my money, to be able to purchase friendship in a sense. And people are doing it. You know, imagine that. I mean, that's your typical day. Just think through what he's feeling and thinking as he wanders through life. Very, very painful. Very, very painful. What other things in this first section just kind of jumped out at you? That you just, you know, stirs you. You just, why do you think that was that way? What is the challenge then for the church after watching something like that? Yeah. See, I think a church looks at a video like this and has two responses. One is, how can we keep our kids from being like that initially? You know, the covenant model. How can we keep that from happening? And what will be the guarantee that that won't happen? Which is a painful reality because we know the corruption of the world and the way it is. The second one is, if it's a church that has a heart for lost people and broken people, it's what can we do to engage those people? Now, can you imagine how messy it's going to get if in your youth ministry, DJ shows up? Yeah. See, it's complicated. And it's going to be a moment of tension because the church has a responsibility to shepherd and reach out and to hopefully shepherd the one we're reaching out to. One of the reasons I show the video, though, is because it creates, is what we've talked about in this class all semester, the five purposes of the church. It really presents that dilemma for us now. Now, someone say, well, you're not going to have kids like that everywhere. Well, you're not. But the problems might not be the exact same. But the root issue of sin, the core of sin, is going to be present. And it's often, not often, there'll be times when it's actually the students who've grown up in the church who will be struggling with those issues as well, perhaps even more than those who are outside the church. And so it presents the reality of it's going to be difficult as we minister to these. And we need to not be naive to how complicated it's going to get, that sin really is messy. We shouldn't be surprised, honestly. It shouldn't be shocking. When you think about what this generation of kids has seen on TV, the kind of stuff that's funneled in freely, like the children watching the Playboy Channel without any supervision at all, it's just no wonder that there isn't more of this and that it's not, you know, present. Because, and I'm not saying I wish it was, of course, it's just the reality is, why wouldn't it? I mean, I was watching last night and I told my wife, I said, remind me never to buy a Casio watch. And she was like, why? I said, because their advertising now is very provocative. They're, you know, marketing a new watch that basically doesn't need batteries. And one of the first scenes, it shows a woman undoing her top and goes to show her cleavage. It irritates me. I'm like, okay, I don't need it at Hardee's or Gold, whatever, Hardee's or the Star restaurant, whatever it's called, Carl Jr.'s, anymore because of their commercials. I don't need it at Rally's because of their commercials. Very sexually explicit in their commercials, and I don't like it. And so my way of protesting is to say I'm not gonna do it. The point is not that you should or shouldn't participate and eat at Hardee's or whatever, but that these kids don't look at that as provocative or even shocking. It's just normal for them. And so the more of that's present, the more of a reality it is for them to find themselves involved in activities like this. And one of the reasons that I really enjoy this documentary is because in the next section, we're going to see DJ particularly getting involved in a church. You're going to see DJ worshiping and singing the songs that youth groups sing. Lord, I lift your name on high. You are my all in all. You're going to hear him sing those songs. And I want to whet your appetite a little bit because the church does something very well there. And very good. I think the intentions and purpose is right. But then something happens, which is very evident in many churches that are reaching out to these kinds of kids now. in his life? And then the second question will have to come, how does the church continue? See, so often, youth ministry has been centered on, we've got kids for 6 years or 4 years, depending on how you break it up, and then they're on their way. And I'm convinced that it's got to look a lot different than that. We must begin to think about long-term relationships. For instance, what is it going to look like when the girl Amy and whoever she ends up marrying come for some level of premarital counseling or counseling in the midst of the marriage? What's it going to be like if she became a believer and the person she's, you know, married is a believer? Those issues are going to be very significant about the kind of activity she was on, don't you think? I mean, just the activity that she was involved in. What's it going to look like? Is the church going to be equipped, prepared to nurture them on through that? Not just giving them the pat answer of, well, you know, in Christ now you're pure, you're forgiven. That's certainly true. But all of the horrible stuff, I mean, every night coming in, shamed, embarrassed, humiliated, frustrated, scared she's going to get caught. That's a lot to deal with and cope with. And as a church, are we going to be aggressive at reaching out and showing love to those kinds of kids now? But, you know, Amy's probably 21 or 22 now, somewhere in there. Well, let's conclude. Let me pray. And then come next week and we'll begin to talk more as we'll see another part of the video. Lord, right now I just want to pray. I want to pray for DJ. I want to pray for Amy. I want to pray for the other high school students, Lord, who I guess perhaps now are in college, whose lives were just showed to us, God, and they were heinous. And we know, Lord, that students like them exist everywhere. And whether it's that kind of gross, massive numbers of sexual activity, or if it's just, Lord, brokenness and social isolation and completely depressed, Lord, we see the needs, and it reminds us again of why you've called people into youth ministry to shepherd these young people, to show them the gospel of hope. And so we pray for them now, because they're real individuals, Lord. They're not just images on a TV screen or on a videotape that we can see. They're real people who right now are breathing and walking. And Lord, may that burn in our hearts and call us, oh God, to a deeper love for you and pleading with you, Lord, to save these souls. God, stir in us a passion for them. We thank you for this. In the name of Jesus, amen.